Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all here to our courtroom, and we have some special guests. We have Mid-State Technical College students. Are they here? Would they please stand? Good. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have Globe University Paralegal Club. Would they please stand? We welcome you again. You were here for the first argument. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. And for those of you who are able to stay, Justice Rogensack will meet with all the students at noon or right after this argument, which will be afternoon, and discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues that we have heard in these cases. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to Justice Bradley's right, Justice David Prosser, and to his right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will just first ask if anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear. If you raise your hand, we will give you a summary of it. All right? Justice Bradley asks, is there a student group here who has not been introduced? Anyone else want to be introduced? This is your time.
There was a hand back in the second row. From
that,
the
we will proceed.
There's a hand Zero. Up in the second row.
Yeah. Pardon me? Is there a hand in the second row? Yes, ma'am. Please stand. Sorry. The acoustics are such that we can't... hear you, so come up, go to the podium.
UW.
This is your first appearance before the Supreme Court.
I'm good. You're
doing fine. State your name.
Emily Musio. We're from UW-Madison, from Political Science, American Judicial Systems.
Ah, very good. Now, will your colleagues please stand with you? Well, we welcome you all. Thank you for introducing yourselves. And you were right, Justice Bradley. We saw some young, as usual, she says, we saw some younger people here at the first argument, and I made the same request, and no one stood. So we're delighted to have you all. You're all invited, as is everyone else. You don't even have to be a student to join in the discussion of the procedures after this second case. I'll now proceed to call the second case today, 09AP2385, Todd Olson versus Robert Farrar, arguing on behalf of the Mount Morris Mutual Insurance Company is Stacey K. Luell. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Stacey Luell, and as said, I represent Mount Morris Mutual Insurance Company. Mount Morris, in this case, issued a farm owner's policy. That's important because what is a farm owner's policy? It is meant to cover farm operations, the farm itself, the insured premises, which can be the actual homestead as well as fields. And as part of insuring that farm operations, it includes those type of operations such as tractors traveling on public roadways between field to field. It is not a policy that is meant to address the risk of a tractor being used outside of the farm operations to transport a mobile home from one uninsured premises to another. With this backdrop in mind, and keeping that in mind, what the risk is involved with this policy and what should be covered, I submit that the affidavit of the insured regarding the design of the tractor should not be considered for two reasons. First, whether a tractor is a motor vehicle under the definition of motor vehicle in the insurance policy is one of contract interpretation. It is not something that should be addressed by an affidavit. The policy defines motor vehicle as a motorized vehicle designed for use on public roads. The second reason why the affidavit should not be considered is because we still are at a stage of whether there's a duty to defend.
We're at a stage of what?
Whether there's a duty to defend. And when you have the duty to defend, you're looking at the four corners of the complaint and comparing them with the policy terms, which is known as the four corners rule, rightly so. So for those two reasons, the affidavit should not be considered.
I have a problem about this last part. We'll get to the problems that I have about the other part. The decision, this is a summary judgment, right? And it's on your motion for a summary judgment to finally decide whether you have a duty to defend, right?
Your Honor, the context of this case was that Mount Morris took the extra precautions to provide a defense to their insured.
I understand.
They immediately bifurcated and stayed, intervened, bifurcated and stayed.
And you did that because that's what this court has said is a good way to do it, to protect you. Okay. That's exactly my point. So you started on the duty to defend just like you're supposed to, and now you want a final decision that you get out of the case and you don't have a duty to defend Mr. Farrar because maybe Mr. Olson's going to continue his lawsuit against Mr. Farrar and that Farrar is going to be maybe liable and won't have insurance. Isn't that the big picture of the case?
That is the big picture. However, I want an early determination whether or not this complaint alleges something that's covered by the...
All right, but it's a final decision. If the court says it's covered, do you get a second kick at that cat?
If the court decides that it is a covered risk,
right,
then it moves to the analysis of duty to indemnify. Because duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify.
Right. And when does it move to the duty to defend?
When it starts with the duty.
When does it move to the duty to indemnify?
It moves to the duty to indemnify when there's not arguable coverage when comparing the four corners of the complaint, the allegations in the complaint, with the policy. And that's important because it's a good way to succinctly, simply look at something and say, hey, is this the type of lawsuit that should be covered?
This is what's confusing me.
Mm-hmm.
The court says you have a duty to defend. Go ahead and defend it. And then it turns out Mr. Farrar is liable to Mr. Olson. Do you have a duty to indemnify?
You would have, if it got to the point where the court said, yes, there's a duty to defend.
Right.
Then we would proceed on a coverage trial to figure out whether or not there's a duty to indemnify.
When would you proceed on a coverage trial?
I'm sorry, excuse me?
When would you proceed on a coverage trial?
Proceed after there's been a determination that there is a duty to defend, an initial duty to defend, and then there would be submissions and there would be a...
Okay. So you're saying that if I hear you right, this is what's confusing me about this, that there's a two-part stage in your bifurcated one part. So if this duty to defend has two parts, one, you do a four-corner test, and then if the insurance company loses on the four-corner test, then you're going to have a next stage where you're going to bring in extrinsic evidence. Is
right.
that your point?
That's correct.
Now, why aren't we doing it all in one set on summary judgment?
Because it's a separate analysis. Because when you are looking at whether or not there's arguable coverage, you're just looking at what do the terms of the policy say compared to what's alleged. In the instance of the fistfight case with Sustash, you see why there is a separate analysis. Because there wasn't an intentional act that was alleged. And so when you're looking at that and you're purely looking at the terms with the allegations, then there's no coverage. And that's the end of the story because duty to defend is broader than duty to indemnify. There is no need to get into the duty to indemnify analysis.
Don't you think that the Sustash case decided by this court is contrary to your position?
I don't. I think Sustache is correctly decided. I think that it's being misinterpreted by the Court of Appeals in this particular case, and there is some confusion among practitioners of how it should be applied. I think Sustache was the type of case where there was already enough there to determine that it was undisputed that there was not a duty to indemnify. It was undisputed that the gentleman who threw the punch intended to cause some type of harm. That is different than this situation. In this situation, you have a class of vehicles, and it's whether or not tractors fall within motor vehicle under the policy terms. You don't have conduct here. You have a situation where it can be decided, the duty to defend can be decided, without going down the route of summary judgment and extrinsic evidence.
Well, the Court of Appeals in this particular case really did not get into a detailed analysis of your summary judgment motion. And I'm wondering whether or not you feel that if the Court of Appeals decision were to stand and this matter goes back now for trial, whether or not the issues that appear to be genuine issues of material fact, such as the nature of the tractor and whether or not it was intended to be used on highways or roads, whether or not that would be an issue at trial.
Well, that gets to my first point, that this really isn't something that should consider extrinsic evidence anyway.
I know, but consider now that the Court of Appeals has made a decision. It's possible we might affirm that decision. If we affirm that decision, this matter goes back for trial. Are those issues of fact going to be open to trial?
The issue of whether this particular tractor was a motor vehicle, which I submit is the wrong analysis because it would create inconsistencies as a John Doe tractor, the same as a Massey Ferguson tractor. But in this particular case, it would go back, and there seems to be, according to the Court of Appeals, a factual issue as to whether this tractor was designed according to specifications of the manufacturers. And that would be a bifurcated trial. It would be a coverage trial, and it would be a determination, I think, by the court in that situation, possibly the jury.
So you think first when this goes back, if it were to go back, it would go back for a coverage trial and then depending on that determination for a full trial?
Right. The merits of the lawsuit are going to be decided separately because there's been a bifurcation.
The Court of Appeals seemed to feel that you did not bring sufficient evidence at the summary judgment hearing on the issue of motor vehicle, which is obviously a central issue in regard to whether there's coverage. Do you disagree with that?
I think that's the crux of the problem, because if you jump immediately to the duty to indemnify, then it becomes this looking at extrinsic evidence. But what I brought was a motion based strictly on the pleadings. I didn't introduce extrinsic evidence in the beginning. I said this is a duty to defend analysis and we need to compare the complaint with the terms of the policy. I'm not exactly sure if I phrased it or titled it summary judgment or declaratory judgment, but it really is, it's looking to the court to decide, applying the four corners, whether or not there's a duty to defend. If the court says yes, there is a duty to defend, then it proceeds on to the duty to indemnify analysis. If the court says no, then that's the end of the story because the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And I think also the way that the Court of Appeals is interpreting this, it creates inconsistencies because in this particular situation, I recommended to my client to use all caution. Hire someone to protect your insured under reservation of rights to prevent any type of default judgment against them. We're going to intervene, move to bifurcate and stay, and have the issue of duty to defend addressed. Another permissible way that I could have recommended to my client would be the Maori way, which would be not to provide an initial defense and immediately move to intervene, bifurcate, and stay, and that would still not be a breach of the duty to defend. However, if I were to do it that way, what the Court of Appeals is telling us through its decision, is that then, at that point, my client would have been able to argue the duty to defend. It's only because of this one procedural difference that my client is unable to use the Four Corners Rule, which has been applied for decades.
Counselor, if I understand your argument, you're saying that the word designed, which refers to the tractor, is not something that's subject to evidentiary proof by anyone, that the court will have to decide whether a reasonable insured would interpret that rule one way that would be different from how the insurance company is interpreting it. So to send it back, as the Court of Appeals does, as a question of fact, is inconsistent with what you do with insurance policies, because we don't have trials as factual trials on what the words in an insurance policy mean. Is that your position?
It is, Your Honor, and I think that's the thing that I've struggled with this whole time with the affidavit that was submitted by the insured, is that this is a matter of contract interpretation. And to have a factual determination on whether one type of tractor is designed for use and another is not, it just will create all kinds of inconsistencies. It will create more litigation, and it ends the policy, and the reason why you have the Four Corners analysis is to have a simple way of looking and addressing the duty to defend at the beginning of the case.
Counsel, you indicated again that the affidavit was submitted by the insured, and you say that on page 16 of your brief, too, that the affidavit was submitted by the insured to argue for coverage. This affidavit was submitted largely without factual support. But I think the record appears to show exactly the opposite, that the affidavit, or the extrinsic evidence, which is the affidavit, was submitted by Stacy K. Lewell, attorney for Mount Morris, to argue against coverage. What's wrong? That's the way that I understood the affidavit. Am I right or wrong on that? It seems like it's certainly inconsistent with what you have on page 16 and what you said in response to Justice Rogensack's.
I guess I'm a little confused. I can tell you what happened. I submitted an affidavit that attached the policy, and I might have attached the complaint, but I certainly did not attach any extrinsic evidence in my moving brief. In response, the insured presented his affidavit, and then in response, in reply, I submitted the Massey Ferguson manual, with always arguing that you shouldn't be considering extrinsic evidence, but in the event that you do, here's the Massey Ferguson manual, and this is what it says about why tractors are used on public roads.
Don't these affidavits and counter-affidavits create a genuine issue of material fact?
It's not an issue of fact, is my position. My position is that this is a matter of contract interpretation, which is decided by looking at the various tenets and rules of contract interpretation. What would a reasonable insured, what would a reasonable insurance company, what would the parties expect? What does the case law say about the definition of motor vehicle or the definition of design for use?
Well, that's why I started my questioning with you. Because once you say that, I just hear this as a plain, simple contract interpretation of the insurance policy. And you apply insurance policy rules, and you have a summary judgment. And it has nothing to do with the concept of the four corners. You look at a contract, and you interpret it to by its language, that's standard. On the other hand, there is a rule that says that if the intent of the parties is outside the language of the contract, you can look outside that and bring in evidence. So my problem is, how do I classify this case? Do I classify it as a four-corner insurance case? Then I run into Justice Cross's decision in Sustash. And then it says, no, I'm not limited to the four corners. Do I classify it as a summary judgment case? Then I get into material issue of fact? Do I classify it as an insurance policy case? And then I get into the rules of interpretation. And the rules of interpretation generally are you look at the words of the step of the contract. You don't go outside. On the other hand, here you have a reference to, what is it designed for? What's the policy's language?
Yes, Your Honor, it's designed for use on public roads.
Okay, designed for use on public roads, which then says, hey, I got to look at this tractor. And that becomes a fact issue. So where I, how I classify this gets my mindset, and I'm, the way I classify it is, I never understood why you were talking about the four corners of the contract. I could either classify it as a summary judgment or as an insurance policy interpretation, and they meld because on some interpretations, you can look outside the contract to decide what those words mean, right? So why are we talking about four corners? I'll get back to that because it seems to me no matter how you cut this, you have to get this whole decision about this insurance contract decided at this stage of the proceeding.
Your Honor, I see this as an interpretation of contract, insurance contract case. And I think...
In a summary judgment or a declaratory, I don't care which one you take, declaratory judgment proceeding.
Right, right. And that would be using the interpretation rules that... discuss looking at the ordinary meaning. You look at in the factual circumstances as alleged in the complaint. You look at it, the factual circumstances in life, and that gets to the ordinary meaning of it. But no, that I do see this as a contract interpretation case.
What's the matter with saying that you look to see what kind of tractor this is? Maybe this is a tractor that can be used both on the farm and on a public road. And they're sold that way, and they're priced that way, and people buy them so that they can use them both ways. I mean, I know nothing about tractors, so why can't I see whether a GM tractor or a John Deere or a Ford or a Mercedes-Benz tractor, they're different in what they're designed for. Why can't we go outside the contract for that?
The problem is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these policies drafted, and many of them use this exact same language. They differ somewhat. But you're looking at a class of vehicles. And to go to a specific type of tractor and try to interpret the policy and apply it in a certain way only for that specific tractor will create inconsistencies. Because then a court can go in and say, no, this John Deere was only designed to be used in the fields, or no, this was used in this manner, or designed in this manner. It's meant, and I think the Varda case is an excellent example of why taking a classification of vehicles is more workable in this situation. The Varda case involved the lawnmower. And you don't look at the specific, was that a John Deere lawnmower that was designed for this? You look at what are tractors, what are lawnmowers intended to be used for? What is an intended use? And an intended use is use on public roadways.
Counsel, you started your argument this morning, if I took my notes correctly, with indicating this is a farm policy. And then you say it is not meant to cover a tractor used on public roads. And if I took that down correctly, that piqued my interest in my ear because that's not the words of the policy. Looking at the appendix, page 64, definition 12, motor vehicle means a motorized vehicle if, and I'm skipping a few words that aren't relevant here, it is designed for use on public roads. Now, you're emphasizing whether or not it is used on public roads. And my concern is that if that's the thread of your analysis, if it meets that definition because it's used on public roads, does that mean when it goes into the field and just used in the field, it is no longer designed for use on public roads? Let me be more specific. It seems to me that your interpretation of design could change hourly depending upon use. And I don't interpret, or it doesn't appear to me, that the insurance contract indicates that. It is designed for use on public roads, not whether it is used at the time of the accident on public roads or it happens to be in the cornfield and used there at the time. Can you help me with that? Because that's a real concern I have for your argument.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand where you're coming from with that. And the connection is the Schlusner case. Design for use has already been interpreted by the court, I think it was a court of appeals case, to mean that it's an intended purpose, a use of something. It's not going to be determined by if it's being used at the field and then it's designed only for field. It's what is the purpose of a lawnmower? What is the purpose, a purpose, because there's multiple purposes, what is a purpose of a tractor? A purpose of a tractor is certainly working in the field, but another purpose of a tractor is traveling from field to field or transporting hay or something to that effect. So it is based on the definition, designed for use, and it is tied to what that class of vehicle, one of the purposes of that vehicle is. And it wouldn't be altered from where it was actually, the location of where it was being used.
I see that case, the Schlusner case. I mean, I hear you saying that it stands for the proposition that you look at how the car is actually being used. But in that Schlusner case, what you had is a car that was designed, I think in the mid-70s as a car. And then later, years later, it was redesigned for a demolition derby car, an off-road car, if you will. And as I read or looked at that opinion, that was what the court was grappling at. What design are we talking about? The initial design that was, I think, in 1975, or the design later that was for a demolition derby car? And I think the court said, no, we are choosing the design for the demolition derby car. So I just see that case a little bit differently, I think.
I'm sorry, do you want to respond to that?
If you don't mind. Yeah, Schlusner is a little different. It talks about a retrofitted car. Mm-hmm. And I think what you can get from Schlusner is that looking at an ordinary meaning of design for use. And in that case, they're saying that looking at it as a purpose or an intended use is what's key. It's not what was, you know, specified early on by the manufacturer. It's what is this vehicle meant to be used for, a purpose of it. In this particular, in the Schlusner case, you had someone who modified the car so much so that they almost redesigned it.
That's right.
And at that point, once that redesign was done, a purpose, or really the only purpose that that vehicle could be used for, was in these demolition derbies.
But what if that car happened to be on the road, driving into the gas station or something like that? Then what do you say? It sounds like your argument would say, oh, it's being used on a road, it's designed to be used on a road, even though in Schlusner they specifically said, no, the subsequent design is what it's designed for. It is designed, not how is it used, what is it designed for? And it was demolition derby off-road.
It all goes to purpose. Is the purpose of this derby car to be used on the road? No. Is the purpose of a tractor to be used on the road a purpose? Yes. We see it all the time on the roadways of Wisconsin. You see it. A purpose of a tractor is to be used in public roads. That's why there are safety laws that apply to tractors. That's why there are manufacturer specifications that say you should use this type of lighting, you should use this type of slow-moving emblem. That's the key difference. It's not where it's being used. The key is a purpose of that vehicle.
So should your policy just have used the word tractor? Would that have helped you in this case? Instead of designed?
The way that the policy is drafted, it's all tied to the insured premises and the farming operations. So it gets tricky.
Okay.
I think that they were meaning to exclude certain things, in particular a tractor being used like a motor vehicle to transport things.
Okay.
They want things tied to the farm.
So I have another one. So should you have said a tractor used for its ordinary farm purposes? That would have included moving the tractor on the road to get to the next field. It would have been for use on the field.
I like that language. However, I think...
You may have it.
Which is, you know, one of the important reasons why we're here, to get some clarification on these things. But I think that the policy drafters were looking for broader language because there are other vehicles besides tractors that would fall into this quandary, you know, lawnmower, ATVs. There's new vehicles being made all the time. And so I think that drafters want to make it broad enough that it applies not just solely to a tractor, but to vehicles and how you can determine. And that's why that purpose thing is so important, because it's looking at what is the purpose of the vehicle.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Veenstra. Representing Robert Farrar.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Justices, Counsel. My name is Joe Veenstra with the law firm of Johns, Flaherty & Collins. I represent Robert Farrar, Robert and Jean Farrar, in the Supreme Court here today visiting, and appreciate your time. Despite the fact that we'd probably rather not be here.
How's the weather out there?
It's beautiful.
Good, okay.
The leaves are changing, so come visit Western Wisconsin.
Thank you.
The court's presented interesting questions here about the Four Corners Rule and the scope of review. And after hearing the discussion about that subject, I've sort of altered my plan here, but I think I'd like to outline some issues that were raised by the justices about the Four Corners Rule and its application in the context we have here. First, Justice Crooks, I believe, asked the question about, isn't Sustash against you? And I think Sustash, and we argued in our brief and have been pretty consistent about it, is on all fours with this. The insurance company chose and followed the court's dictates to appoint counsel and pay for counsel for Mr. Farrar. They immediately intervened, bifurcated, and got the stay of any issues relating to liability, and we began the discussion about coverage under this policy. And Sustash, the court there, said, under those circumstances, you're not bound by the Four Corners Rule. That rule has been applied in other cases, and it does not appear to be a big problem for insurance companies, in my opinion. In fact, I've not been here before, so I listened to the oral argument online in Sustash, and the insurance company there was American Family, and the attorney that represented American Family was questioned directly about that, and he indicated, we have no problem going beyond the Four Corners Rule in a situation where we've chosen to appoint counsel. And that's for good reason, because at that point, you've essentially admitted that there is a defense at that point. Then you look to indemnity, and it's kind of unusual to talk about because this works both ways. If you don't have indemnity, you don't have a duty to defend, obviously. If you don't have a duty to defend, you don't even have to worry about indemnity. It works both ways. And I guess I take some pleasure in the Chief Justice's question about, isn't this just a motion for summary judgment? Because the way I look at it is, why don't we put it all on the table in one hearing about whether there is a duty to defend, if they think this is a type of policy that doesn't apply based on this wasn't an occurrence, for example. In a lot of the self-defense cases that we've looked at over the years, Sustash was one of them. Is an intentional act an occurrence under the policy? And most of the time, I think you've said no. And for that reason, there was no duty to defend, and you move on. So I think, you know, if there's questions about how to apply the Four Corners Rule, I would err on the side of let's not worry about the Four Corners Rule. Let's let people, if they have objections to the way the allegations of complaint are laid out, put their facts before the court. If there's some disagreement with that, that's what the courts are there for.
Counselor, I think if I understand opposing counsel's position, and I'm not really tied up with we use the Four Corners or we look at the way Sustache looked at it or whatever, I think what she's saying is, and I assume that the insurance policy was attached to the complaint. Is that a correct assumption?
No. In fact, I don't think the insurance policy was attached because they weren't provided it pre-litigation.
Well, then you maybe have to go step by step. But in any case, what she's saying is regardless of what you're doing here, when you interpret the word designed for, it's not an evidentiary issue. It is an interpretation of a policy, and you don't take evidence on that. What she's saying is you just interpret it as we did in the Varda case and say, is this a purpose of a lawnmower? Okay, so she's saying, is this a purpose of a tractor? Well, you interpret the contract in that regard. So there wouldn't really be an evidentiary hearing, and I think that's why she objects to the affidavit of the insured, because he's trying to make it a fact question about whether this particular tractor was designed for use on a roadway. So, you know, I think we get far afield and we talk a lot about is it the Four Corners analysis or it is a broader analysis. I think the reason for that is that she looks at it as simply a contract question. And so we interpret insurance contracts all the time, regardless of when we say we're doing them, if we say we're doing them for liability or if we say we're doing it for duty to defend, we interpret them all the time. And so I think that's more her point. Can you respond to that? Why should we have an evidentiary hearing on design for, as that's what the Court of Appeals is sending it back for? Why should we do that? Why shouldn't we just interpret this word in the policy as a reasonable insured would interpret it?
Well, first, I'd invite you to interpret it as I think a reasonable insured would interpret it.
Of course.
Be to that it is designed, not designed for use on a public road. It's a farm tractor. I think if you asked 1,000 Wisconsinites, is a tractor like this one designed for use on a public road, they'd say, no, it's designed for farming and fields. And I think the Court of Appeals wanted to remand it for a discussion of that issue and perhaps an evidentiary hearing on that. But I think this court could rule as a matter of law that this tractor is a tractor and it's designed for use in fields like every farmer in Wisconsin thinks a tractor is designed for. So I guess to the extent you're saying, is this a contract issue? Arguably, I could see you going there. It's a little challenging because there are so many different types of tractors out there. I mean, there are tractors with full-blown headlights, and they can go 50 miles an hour and have a lot of accoutrements on them that make them useful on public roads, and they need to go farther. Big farms.
But when you say that to me in response, what you're really saying to me is, you have to interpret the word of the insurance policy in light of a particular tractor, not generally tractors as a class, correct?
Sure. I agree with that.
I think that's contrary to opposing counsel's position. She wants us to interpret tractors as a class. Do you think that's correct? I can understand
why an insurance company would want that. As a general rule, it makes it cleaner and easier for them. But I think it's, number one, it's almost impossible. And number two, they have every opportunity when they write the policy to visit the farm and see what they're trying to insure here and decline to if they want to. This isn't some situation where they don't have that opportunity. I think even if you look at the record, there is a handwritten attachment to the policy where whoever sold the policy went through the whole farm and talked about everything on there. And it's a little different than a real general like auto policy, I think. So if they want to not write it, they're free to.
Okay. Thank you.
I did want to address the issue of extrinsic evidence and the Four Corners Rule and the problems I see with that. In the proposal that my opposing counsel here is making, they're saying, the insurance companies generally are saying, if we think there's a duty to defend issue, the insured is essentially rendered mute.
The insured is what?
Rendered mute. even though they're a party, they have no business in the court saying anything about how they are applying the policy to the facts alleged by a third party. That is a challenge, I think, for insureds, and it actually is true in this case as how it's applied, because the plaintiff in this case pled it as, you know, this tractor popped a wheelie on the hill and rolled backwards, and there was a damage caused to a truck. It really wasn't clear what was involved in between the tractor and the truck. And what was there was a trailer home. And the trailer home was what struck the truck. I think I'm correct about how that was articulated in the complaint. And our insured says, listen, take a look at this policy with me. I have a farm policy. I think, you know, I should have coverage here. I think it's only fair to a litigant to be able to say, listen, there was a trailer involved here, and it is what smashed into the truck, and I'm entitled to a voice about how the policy should be applied to the true facts. There's been some discussion over the years about exceptions to the Four Corners Rule. I believe if you look at the early cases on the Four Corners Rule, there were two cases. One is the Grebe case, which was in 1967, in which the Grebe court cited the ALR 50, ALR 2nd, 458, and it indicated that there could be exceptions when there's a conflict between the allegations and known facts. Two, where the allegations are ambiguous or incomplete. Three, where the allegations state facts partly within and partly outside of the coverage provided. And four, where the allegations state conclusions rather than facts. I think the situation here is sort of a combination of one and two. There's a conflict between the allegations in the complaint and known facts. And number two, where the allegations are ambiguous or incomplete. It's a little bit of both. And then about 20 years later in 1987, there was the Berg versus Fall case, which a lot of insurance companies have bemoaned and the court has sometimes criticized. But that case cited the Appleman's insurance law, section 4683, for the proposition that an insurer cannot safely assume that the limits of its duty to defend are fixed by the allegations of that a third party chooses to include in the complaint, because an insurer's duty is measured by true facts that may be within coverage or potentially within coverage and are reasonably ascertainable by the insurer. I raise those because I think it sort of outlines some of the challenge that may exist for potential insureds in these coverage-type cases. And this is one of those cases where I think our insured had a good cause to submit an affidavit about what the true facts were in the case. And as an aside, there was an allegation that he didn't have permission to haul this trailer, which is an absurdity, and I don't think was even argued by opposing counsel on appeal. To the extent that the court may be analyzing the Four Corners Rule, I think Sue Stosch, if I'm pronouncing that right, is fine law. It's not old law that needs to be reviewed. It was a unanimous decision of this court applying insurance law, and I don't think insurance companies are having any real serious problem with it. I think if an insurance company doesn't want to use Sue Stosch, they don't have to appoint counsel. They can make the choice not to and take the risks if they feel like it. But
when you say take the risks, you mean take the risks of some kind of a bad faith action?
It's possible. I mean, I think I was looking at Attorney Arnold Anderson's manual, which is like a touchstone.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, there's these four possibilities from the Bauman case that an insurance company can decide. He says there's a fifth, which is just blow everything off and don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, if they want to make this choice, that's fine. But they shouldn't expect to get the four corners because the law has been clear and the courts have applied it. There have been two cases. I referenced Bauman versus Elliott. That actually predated Sue Stosch, but it was very similar. Counsel was appointed, and the court looked beyond the Four Corners Rule. There was an unpublished decision, but it was a three-judge Court of Appeals panel in Lenzke, L-E-N-Z-K-E, versus Brinkman Pools, which also went beyond the Four Corners Rule in a situation where counsel had been hired by the insurance company early on in the litigation. So I think the Sue Stosch law is good law and should be followed. If the court feels that it needs to somehow analyze the Four Corners Rule more, I guess from my position, from the position of the Farrars and my experience in trying to do these cases, is that there should be some exceptions to the Four Corners rule in situations like this where you have some ambiguity in the original complaint.
Is your understanding, then, of the Sustash with regard to the Four Corners and extrinsic evidence that in a situation, I think, like here, where the insurer has satisfied its initial duty to defend by providing counsel to its insured and seeks a judicial determination of its continued defense obligation or other coverage, Wisconsin permits introduction of extrinsic evidence where appropriate to the resolution of the coverage question?
Exactly.
That's out of paragraphs, I think, 27 to 29, I think.
Yes, I think that's fine law.
If that's the position, and that we can use extrinsic evidence and get outside the four-corner rule, then it seems to me the question is, this is a contract interpretation case, right? Ordinarily, you don't go outside. Why would you go outside the words of the contract here? Now, the words of the contract, let me make sure we're all talking about the same word, is it three, sub three of the 5B3, a motorized vehicle which is designed only for use off public roads?
I don't think the word only is in there.
It's in my copy, and it's in Ms. Lowell's brief.
Oh, that's a separate section. I was thinking of the following section, yes.
So what is the exact words we're talking about?
A motor vehicle means a motorized vehicle, which is also defined in the policy, if it is designed for use on public roads.
Well, that's not what 3 says.
I'm looking at
right.
Page 64 of the appendix.
Yeah,
yes.
I know what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Okay, so can we look at extrinsic evidence?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
My question is, do we look at extrinsic evidence? Now, I know you want to win, and you want to win as simply as possible. And for your purposes, you don't totally agree with the Court of Appeals decision. You would prefer that it not go back, and that you would prefer, as a matter of law, this court decide that your client is covered, that this tractor is covered. Isn't that your position?
Well, to the extent I may have made a mistake in not cross-petitioning for review on that issue, we were so happy with the win that we'll go back and fight it in the trial court if you'll let us.
Right. I understand that. And you don't have to defend every single word. You're defending the Court of Appeals, but your position was we could decide this as a matter of law here.
I really think you could, yes. I did want to address the Schlusner case that was referenced by Justice Bradley earlier. I did want to point out that the Schlusner case involved a little bit different language. And the language in that case was, quote, designed mainly for use off public roads while not on public roads. Right? So they clarified it a little more than is the situation we have here. Also, I do have the same concerns about the application of the Schlusner case to these facts in that, you know, you can't pick the time when you want to use how the tractor is defined. If the tractor was sunk in the bottom of the ocean, you know, I think it creates a lot of problems. I think the Schlusner case is somewhat of an outlier in very unusual facts, but to the extent that opposing counsel is arguing that you look at the design of the vehicle at the time of the accident or the time the damage is caused, I still think, even though they were on a road at the time of the accident, that it was designed for use off the road. It was designed to farm. So even if you agreed with Mount Morris that is when you look at the design of the vehicle, I think we'd still win. So I think it's a win either way, whether you think Schlusner applies to this situation or not.
Is the phrase "designed for use" ambiguous or unambiguous?
I think it's really ambiguous, with particularly with regard to this tractor, because there's so many types of tractors. I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but if you're saying it's ambiguous, that means that it should be interpreted to favor our insured. So that's another reason why I think we should win on that issue. I did want to mention there hasn't been really any discussion on whether the earlier questions about coverage dealt with whether the property damage resulted from a mobile home trailer. All right, and I think it clearly did. The mobile home trailer was what struck the truck that Mr. Olson was driving.
What about the damage to the mobile home trailer itself? Isn't that a claim also?
That is part of his claim as well.
Okay, how do you say that the damage to the mobile home trailer resulted from the mobile home trailer?
Well, there may be a question about whether there's two different levels of coverage here, one that doesn't exist and one that does exist, but we would have a defense to the case either way. Mm-hmm. And that same is true for the question regarding the here custody and control exclusion, that if you did find coverage, that there's an exclusion for care, custody, and control. Here, some of the property that was damaged was not in the care, custody, and control exclusively, certainly, of Mr. Farrar. It was the truck that Mr. Olson was driving. So we get outside that. If the court is not convinced that Mr. Farrar didn't have or thinks he had exclusive control of the tractor and the trailer home, then there may be some issues with care, custody, and control there. We would argue that this was basically a plan of his daughter's fiance, and he was sort of just going along with it to be a nice guy and be careful what you wish for, and got into this pickle, and he didn't really have exclusive control, so that the care, custody, and control exclusion should not apply, and those provisions have been deemed ambiguous as a matter of law by this court on multiple occasions, I believe.
Aren't those provisions, if I understood your brief, I thought you argued those provisions really are to prevent first-party coverage because the policy is really a third-party coverage and a liability coverage, or am I incorrect on that?
That's exactly right. The reason for those provisions are to deter an insured from making itself an insurer, a guarantor of its own workmanship, and that's not the situation here. I don't think I have anything else unless the justices have any other questions. I'd be happy to.
Are there any other questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Feenstra. Ms. Lowell.
There are just a few points that I wanted to address after hearing opposing counsel's statement. First of all, the tractor is insured if it's used in connection with the operations of the farm, if it's connected to the insured premises. So in that instance, there would be insurance for the tractor. Secondly, the analysis is an objective analysis. It's what a reasonable insured would interpret and what the parties would interpret specific terms in a policy to mean. And for an insured in every single case to say, well, I interpreted it this way, I interpreted it that way, again results in inconsistency and more litigation. The objective test is there because it is meant to have broad strokes. There are thousands of farm policies in Wisconsin, and it has to be interpreted in a way that provides consistency.
So, counsel, you started your comments with the tractor is insured if it's used for purposes of the farm. So it's in the field, and it's insured. And it wants to drive to the next field, and it goes on the road for 90 yards and pulls into the next field. When it's on the road, you're saying it's not insured.
Quite to the contrary. I'm saying it is insured because it's connected to the insured premises. Insured premises definition includes adjacent causeways, things like that, and insured premises also relates to the overall farming operations.
Okay. Now let's say, as is often in the situation here in Wisconsin. You've got 40s, or you've got a couple of farms going on, so they're not contiguous. It's not a matter of 90 yards. It's a matter of you have the neighbor's farm that you're handling down the road and renting that property. So maybe it's a mile and a half down the road to get to your neighbor's farm. It is, or what was your neighbor's farm anyway, is it covered while on the road?
Yes, it is covered while on the
road. But here, even though it's being used on a public road, it's being covered. How does that tie into the exact words of your prop? This gets me back to my problem with design for the use on the public road, because I hear your arguments to kind of get rid of the word it's designed for use on the public road and just focusing, you know, how's it being used. But if it is on the public road, driving a mile and a half until it gets to a field on what was the adjacent farm, is it covered if it's being used on the public road?
Again, the key is the purpose. What is the purpose for the use of that tractor?
Okay,
is it related to the operations?
That, where do you get that in the policy?
The purpose?
Yeah, where do you get your response
in
the policy?
I get that from the definition of design for use that was discussed by the Schlusner case, as well as dictionary and common usage definitions of design for use. A purpose, an intended purpose, is how it's defined. And in this particular case, using a tractor to move a mobile home that has nothing to do with the insured premises, nothing to do with the farm, is not a purpose. It is not a risk that the parties contemplated when this policy was drafted.
Is there any inconsistency between the word, how you define motor vehicle, and the language on page 5 and 6, 5 of your brief?
5 of my moving brief?
Yep. It's your brief, right, where you talk about motorized vehicles. We pay bodily damage which occurs on a policy results from a motorized B3. A motorized vehicle, which is not quite the same. Oh, that's the above definition. Motorized vehicle is a self-propelled land or amphibious vehicle, regardless of method of service contact. Right?
I guess I'm not quite understanding the question, but I think motorized vehicle is a greater category, and motor vehicle falls within
it. It's defined that way. But then it says motorized vehicle, which is designed only for use off public roads.
And that's the definition of motor vehicle, which is a subset of motorized vehicles.
Yeah, but the subset of motor vehicle as defined, it doesn't say only. It says designed for use.
Yes. There are 3 subsections to 5B. 1 is the golf cart, result of a golf cart. 2 is utility trailer. 3 is motorized vehicle, which designed only for use off public roads. That's a separate section than what we have focused on, which is number 2. And number 2 would refer you to the definition of motor vehicle, and motor vehicle is defined as designed for use on public roads.
Council, does 63232 have any implication here? There it defines motor vehicle. I'm talking about the statutes, defines motor vehicle, and it says motor vehicle does not include farm tractors. What implication of that is that, if any?
I believe that was addressed in the Snorrett case or one of those cases. That was discussing the insurance parameters for automobile liability policies. There has been repeated case law in Wisconsin that has defined a tractor as a motor vehicle, including this. There has been statutes that discuss that as well, in particular those safety statutes that talk about using lighting and slow-moving vehicle signs when on the roadway. I think I'm out of time. Any other questions?
Yes, not, Ms. Lowell.
Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for excellent arguments on the four-corner rule and interpretation of a contract here, an insurance policy. That concludes our hearing in 09 AP 2385, Todd Olson versus Robert Farrar. Those who wish to remain should remain, and Justice Rogan-Zack will be out and talk with you. You may be joined by other students. The court is in recess until 1:30 when it will hear its third case. We are in recess.